Wonderful to be with everyone this morning. It's been a joy to worship our God together. I'm confident that the things that we've done here this morning have glorified Him. And if that is the case, then I'm confident we've been edified. It's my hope and prayer that the things I prepared to discuss with you this morning and our lesson will be a benefit to you, that you would take these things to heart and to consider them in the scope of your life and make the best application that you can. If you would turn to Exodus chapter 2, we'll revisit this passage a few times this morning, especially Exodus 2 and verse 2. In the time when the taskmasters of the Egyptians had a heavy hand on the Israelites as they were in Egypt, it says in verse 1 of Exodus 2 that a man of the house of Levi went and took as wife a daughter of Levi. We learn in chapter 6 that that was Amram and Jochebed. And the woman, Jochebed, conceived and bore a son. When she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months so that he would not die at the hand of the Egyptians according to the commandment of Pharaoh. We read, I believe, in the 10th verse, that man would be Moses. That was the name given him because he was fished out of the river. We remember the story well. We're familiar with it. We make many applications of it, and we learn it in Bible classes, hear it preached on in sermons, teach it to our children. What I want to consider is the phrase that they saw the child was beautiful, and so they hid him for 3 months. We're going to revisit that idea and understand the significance of it, hopefully, this morning. But because Jochebed and Amram, the mother and father of Moses, had that understanding of God and of their child and saw that he was beautiful, and not fearing the commandment of Pharaoh, they hid him, Moses grew into a man and became the great hero of faith that we read about in Scripture. In Hebrews chapter 11, he's mentioned among many of the exemplars of faith. We oftentimes call this chapter in the New Testament the roll call of faith, or the hall of faith, even, reminding us of the idea of a hall of fame. Certainly Moses was one of those who, if there was a hall of fame of people of faith, would be in it, which is why I think the Hebrew writer, by inspiration of the Spirit, mentioned him. He was a key character and person in the story of Israel and in the Exodus from Egypt, the giving of the law, the establishment of the nation. And he was an exemplar of faith to those people, to the people of the New Testament, to the people that are here today. We read a little bit about the faith of Moses in Hebrews 11 and verse 24. It says that by faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He would be raised in an Egyptian household as the son of the king of Egypt's daughter. And it's very likely that he would be next in line to the throne. And there came a time when, as he reached the fullness of age, that he made the key decision in his life not to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter and to assume the throne himself in Egypt one day. But it says in verse 25 that he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. The throne was in his sight. He could have taken the throne of the world power at that time. Instead, he decided to go with what is seemingly a lowly nation of these Israelitish people, and suffer with them, suffer affliction of the people of God. You consider what was at his disposal, the resources that he had. It says he decided to enjoy affliction rather than the passing pleasures of sin. I want to tell you that the devil's good at what he does, and he lures us with the pleasures of sin in this life. It's all around us, especially we in the affluent country of America have it at our fingertips. Whatever we want, essentially, we can get You want to think of that on a greater level, though? Think of Moses. You think of Solomon sometimes. It says there was nothing under the sun that could be withheld from him. Everything he wanted, he had, but he saw that it was all vanity. That was at Moses' disposal. I could have anything. Is it money? I'd have money. Is it power? I'm next in line to the throne. Do I want women? I'm the son of Pharaoh's daughter. I can have any woman I want. Think of any of the pleasures of sin that might have been there as a temptation of Moses, and he, in his great faith, decided to forego that and suffer instead. It says in verse 27, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. I'm not afraid of Pharaoh. I'm forsaking Egypt. He endured seeing him who was invisible. He feared the one who could destroy both body and soul in hell, not just his body in Egypt. It says, by faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. He was at the helm of the observance of the Passover, the first Passover to be observed, at the pinnacle of all of the plagues, the tenth one, that the destroyer would come and take the firstborn of all in Egypt. He instructed, through inspiration of God, the children of Israel to slay that lamb and do it in this manner, to observe this feast and to put that blood on the doorpost so that that angel of death is not going to take your firstborn. And by his instruction that God gave to them through him, the firstborn of the Israelites were saved. And that broke Pharaoh's spirits, and he finally did let them go. We remember the story that he followed them. His heart was hardened once again. But by faith in verse 29, with Moses as the leader, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. We remember the words of Moses in Exodus 14 as he led them through the Red Sea. He told them in verse 13 of Exodus 14, do not be afraid. You've got mountains on your left and right. You've got the sea in front of you and the Egyptians closing in behind you. Don't be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. Confidence. The Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. God delivered them, certainly. Moses had the faith that it took to, as one man, take that leadership role and at the front of that great nation of Israel walk through the Red Sea and then turn around and see the Egyptians destroyed. This was a great man, a man of great trust in the Lord, a man of conviction, a man that had confidence in the God of Israel. And it said of him in Deuteronomy, the 34th chapter, after he died, that since then, in verse 10 of Deuteronomy 34, there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. And all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt before Pharaoh, before all his servants, and in all his land, by all that mighty power and all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. He told the Israelites before in his recitation of the law in Deuteronomy that there will be a prophet like me that's going to come. Him you shall hear. Moses became a type of the Christ who would save the world from their sins. Moses was a great prophet, the greatest prophet who foreshadowed the transcendent prophet who was the Son of God. This individual did not just do it by constraint in the sense of he did not have a choice. This individual did it by faith. He heard the word of the Lord and he was convicted by it and he put his full trust in God and it was exhibited throughout his entire life. Even when he made the grave mistake of striking the rock twice instead of speaking to it like God instructed him, and he was kept from entering that great promised land that he looked forward to his entire life, he still understood there was hope. God was a God of forgiveness. He put his trust in the Lord. And his name is enrolled in Hebrews chapter 11 as a great man of faith. Let's consider, though, where it started. It said, by faith Moses did these things. But I want to see in Hebrews 11 who had the faith that led to the faith of Moses. Because the section of Moses in Hebrews chapter 11 doesn't really start with Moses. It starts with his parents. In Hebrews 11 and verse 23, the scripture reads, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command." It said, by faith Moses, but it wasn't Moses' faith in verse 23. By faith Moses was hidden when he was born by his parents. The parents had the faith. It said that what we just read back in Exodus chapter 2, when Amram and Jochebed had Moses and they saw he was a beautiful child, so they hid him, not fearing the commandment of the king, not fearing the wrath of Pharaoh. They did that by faith in God. You think a little bit about that for a second. This great man of faith, Moses, where did it start? What if his parents did not exhibit faith in God? Would this great man of faith be recorded for us? Would we be learning about Moses? Would we be thinking about how Moses lived and what he did? No, but because his parents had faith, he grew to be a great man of faith. We remember the command of Pharaoh in Exodus chapter 1 and 2. When that Pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph, he looked at the children of Israel, saw they were more and mightier than we, Exodus 1 and verse 10. So he said, "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land." So in verse 22, he commanded, "Every son who is born, you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." But no, not Amram and Jochebed. We're not going to throw our son into the river. We're not going to kill our son. We're not going to let you take our son. By faith, not fearing the commandment of the king, they hid Moses. The record reads this way. In Exodus 2 and verse 1, "A man of the house of Levi went and took his wife, a daughter of Levi, a woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank." What great faith and trust in God that took. "His sister stood afar off," that's Miriam, "to know what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside. And when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, 'This is one of the Hebrew children.' Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, 'Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?' And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Go.' So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages.' So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, 'Because I drew him out of the water.' When he became of age," we read in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 24, "that he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter." And the result was this great man of faith, because of the faith of his parents who did not fear Pharaoh, hid him. He became that deliverer that Joseph spoke of in Genesis 50 and verse 24. "I am dying," Joseph said, "but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Children of Israel knew of this deliverance. And especially it was on their minds when the hands of the Egyptians grew heavy upon their shoulders, and they dealt shrewdly with them, and they started killing their firstborn and their sons, and they started trying to diminish their number. Amram and Jochebed, they remembered God. They had faith in God. They did not let Moses be taken by Pharaoh. They hid him. And then by faith, they sent him down that river. And God, through His providence, delivered him and kept him safe. Started with Moses' parents. And he led the Egyptians, or the Israelites, out of the Egyptian bondage. And ultimately, up to the precipice of the Promised Land. But I want us to consider a little bit about the reason why, by faith, Moses' parents hid him from the Egyptians. It says that they saw he was a beautiful child, so they hid him. You just think about that for a while. I don't have children, but I know when you look at a precious little baby, how amazing that is, especially when it's related to you. I can't even imagine when it's your own. But you know. When you have that baby and that baby's born and you hear that cry, you don't cringe and think how terrible this is going to be as this child's parent. You think, look at that beautiful, that gorgeous baby. They saw he was a beautiful child and they hid him. But I want to tell you it means more than that. They didn't just see that this baby was handsome. Like all parents see their children, it doesn't matter if that's the ugliest kid in the world. The parent thinks that child is beautiful. That's not what this is talking about. It's not talking about looks. It's not talking about the sweet little sound that baby makes. It's not talking about those big, beautiful eyes. Consider what Stephen says in Acts the 7th chapter and in verse 20 when he gives his defense before the Sanhedrin council. During the time of the Egyptian oppression of the Israelites, it says in verse 20 of Acts 7, at this time Moses was born and was well-pleasing to God. Another translation could be beautiful to God. And we read that in other translations. He was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. The Greek phrase is osteos, which means fair, comely, or pleasing, ho, which is two, and theos, which is God. Osteos, ho, theos. He was fair to God. He was beautiful to God. They saw he was a beautiful child. In what way? They saw he was beautiful to God. Albert Barnes, in his notes on the New Testament, comments on this phrase, osteos, ho, theos, fair to God. And he says the Greek was fair to God. Some translations don't mention God. It just says very beautiful or handsome. It was exceedingly fair, is the King James Version and American Standard Version. Albert Barnes says it was fair to God, properly rendered, was very handsome. The word God in the Greek here, in accordance with the Hebrew language, he says, by which anything that is very handsome, lofty, or grand is thus designated. What Albert Barnes is saying is that it was a figure of speech to show that he was not just an ordinary baby. He was extremely handsome in the physical appearance. He was a beautiful baby. But I want us to consider what the Greek actually says. It doesn't say he was exceedingly fair. It says he was fair to God. Theos is in the Greek. He was beautiful to God. More accurate translation is lovely in the sight of God, New American Standard Bible, well-pleasing to God, as we read in the New King James Version, and beautiful in God's sight. Linsky, another commentator, makes his comments on this verse and takes a different position than Albert Barnes. He says, Stephen intimates that God is with Moses from the very beginning. He says the phrase fair or beautiful to God is not a Hebraistic superlative. It's not figurative language. The dative, he says, is ethical and has a distinct personal flavor. Note how Stephen connects Moses with God even when Moses was still a babe. I want to tell you that Amram and Jochebed, parents of Moses, they did not simply see that he was a handsome baby. They saw that he was a gift from God, and not just a gift from God, that he was beautiful in God's sight. He was a significant being to the God of the universe. God looked on that baby Moses with purpose. God did not view that baby Moses as he does the rest of creation. He viewed that as a soul, a creation in the image of God. He was beautiful to God. And I'm convinced that the parents of Moses understood that to a certain degree. That baby has a purpose. That baby came from God. And God sees that baby as beautiful. We see him in the same respect. And I want to tell you that they thought he had a purpose to fulfill in relation to God. We're not told that God gave them some kind of a vision or a prophecy about how Moses would become the deliverer of Israel that Joseph foreshadowed. God will visit you. He'll deliver you. We don't know if they were told specifically or if they were told anything along those specific lines of Moses, exactly what it was. But I'm convinced that as Stephen says, he was fair to God, he was beautiful to God, and they hid him because they saw he was beautiful, that they understood he has a part to play in all of this. I don't know how big, I don't know how small. I know mothers and fathers, they have high hopes and views of their children, want them to do great things. I think they may have thought that. He's going to be a great Israelite. He's going to have some significance. It's going to be according to God. They hid him by faith. Moses began to be a great man of faith. Stephen continues in this defense of himself, and he says, when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. Moses was learned in the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. Remember Hebrews 11? He decided not to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. When he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian, for he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand. But they did not understand. I don't know why Moses thought this exactly. I don't know why he thought that deliverance that Joseph told his brethren about was going to come through his leadership. But what I do know is that Moses knew that those Israelites, they're not the slaves of the Egyptians of which I'm a part. They're my brethren. He cared for them. He visited his brethren. And he saw one of them suffering wrong, so he acted rashly. I think he sinned in doing this. He slayed that Egyptian, but it was out of that love, out of that I would suggest to you, somewhat righteous indignation in his mind at least. And he supposed that they would understand, I'm going to deliver, God's going to deliver you through my hand. I'm going to be at the helm of this Exodus. He knew some things. He knew his brethren. He knew about that prophesied deliverance. He thought he would have a part to play. We read Hebrews 11 and verses 24 through 27. We saw that he knew some other things. It says that he chose rather to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. He knew they were the people of God, but not only that, but I'm one of them. They're my brethren. He said the reason he did that is because he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. He looked to the reward. You know what Moses knew about? You know what he had a knowledge of? He had a knowledge of heaven. He had a knowledge of heavenly treasure. He had a knowledge that this physical universe is not all there is. There's something greater. There's the realm of God, and it's his intention for us to be with him. And if I live by faith, if I follow them and I serve the Jehovah, the God of the Israelites, the God, the one and only true God of the universe, then I can get those treasures in heaven. It mentions that he suffered the reproach of Christ. He knew something about the seed promise, I think is what that's telling us. Back before he was born, the father of the Israelite nation, Abraham, father of Isaac, who is the father of Jacob, was given the seed promise. And you, all the families of the earth, shall be blessed. You think that that continued through the Israelite teaching, that the Israelites knew of that? He knew of the seed promise. He may not have known all the details, but he knew the families of the earth would be blessed. He knew about the seed promise, the Christ. He forsook Egypt. He saw God, who's invisible, put his faith in him. Not in the idols that were in Egypt. He put his faith in the invisible, one and only true God. I want to ask you a question. Where did he learn all of these things? It said that he was learned in the schools of the Egyptians, but the Egyptians don't teach about Jehovah. We remember Pharaoh's response when Moses and Aaron asked for him to let the people of Israel go so they could go sacrifice to God. He said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him? Who's Jehovah? I don't acknowledge him. I don't look to him. I don't believe in him. We've got our own gods. We've got multiplicity of gods." He didn't learn that in Pharaoh's household. I'm convinced that the time that he was with his parents took advantage of that time because they saw he was a gift from God and he was meant to be for the purposes of God. They took advantage of that time they had with him and they taught him the way of the one and only true God. It said that Miriam saw them and she decided to interject and she asked, "Should I go get one of the Hebrews to be his nurse?" But Miriam knows who the mother of Moses is. So she goes and gets Jochebed, Moses' mother. Not just any Hebrew woman. She goes and gets her mother, who is the mother of her brother, Moses, and she nurses him. And it says in verse 10 that when the child grew, then he became the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And in verse 24 of Hebrews chapter 11, then he decided not to be the son of Pharaoh's daughter. We don't know exactly how long that period of time is, but what I think we can get from implication in the scriptures is that someone had to teach him a little bit about Jehovah. Someone had to teach him about the seed promise. Someone had to teach him about the deliverance that was to come. Someone had to teach him about heaven. Someone had to teach him about spirituality and faithfulness and obeying the command of Jehovah. Someone had to teach him that. And that was ingrained in his mind to the extent that when he became of age, he decided, I'm not going to sin. I'm going to follow God by faith. Consider this quote from the James Fawcett and Brown commentary on the New Testament and Old Testament. He comments, the origin of the scheme that Moses was saved by was most probably owing to a divine suggestion, as its success was due to an overruling providence who not only preserved the child's life, but provided for his being trained in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Hence it is said to have been done by faith, either in the general promise of deliverance or some special revelation made to Amram and Jochebed. And in this view, the pious couple gave a beautiful example of a firm reliance on the Word of God, united with an active use of the most suitable means. His age when removed to the palace is not stated, but he was old enough to be well instructed in the principles of the true religion, and those early impressions, deepened by the power of divine grace, were never forgotten or effaced. They saw he was beautiful to God and they did something about it. You're not here for any other purpose, not to be a great ruler in Egypt. You're not here to learn magic. You're not here to learn astronomy or hieroglyphics. You're here for God. He gave you to us, put you in our care. We're going to teach you about that. Consider this other quote from McGarvey's commentary on the New Testament. It's beautiful to God. McGarvey says that the most striking thing about his education was the power and influence of his mother. Amidst all the wealth, sin, and culture of the court life and the learned of the day, Moses was held in the mighty power of religious training and love of devout parents. There could hardly be a more concrete illustration of the influence and power of godly parents over the life of a sincere and talented child. All that wealth and learning had to offer could not throttle nor thwart the faithful training of the home. If parents were worried about the danger of public education, as well they may be, perhaps they should look to their own home teaching of their child first. The time and place to save a child must be from crib to college in the home, under the daily teaching by word and example of devout parents who love Christ and know His Word. That gives life to it, doesn't it? Brings about a power in that phrase, they saw he was a beautiful child, so they hid him. They didn't just see he was a handsome baby. They saw that he was a gift from God. That this little being has a soul and has a purpose in this life. And that purpose, no matter how specific they knew it was to be at the helm of the deliverance, was to fear God and keep His commandments, was to be a servant of the Most High. And they taught Him when they had the opportunity. They trained Him up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Parents would do well to learn from Amram and Jochebed about what it means to be a parent, about who that child is that's in your care. We should understand what a child's purpose is. In the 127th Psalm, in verse 3, we see the maker of all children, of all people. 127th Psalm in verse 3, the psalmist says, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. They come from God, and they're a blessing. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. Beautiful to God. Came from God. It's a blessing from the Lord. David noted of himself in Psalm 139 and verse 13 that God, you formed my inward parts. You're my maker. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. Saying, you formed me. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. When I look at myself, when I consider who I am, not just in the makeup of my physical flesh, but I'm created in the image of God. That strikes fear in me. That strikes awe and reverence in me toward you, my Creator. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And you knew who I was before anyone else did. When I was in the darkness of the womb, he speaks in figurative language, lowest parts of the earth. You knew I existed. You knew who I was. You knew what I was created for. It's created for you. It's created for God. That's an incredible sentiment, which is why the psalmist says in Psalm 8 and verse 3, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, look at all of that glory. What is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor. Job said in Job 7 and verse 17, what is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment? What is man? Why is God so concerned with us? Why is God viewing us as such a special individual? Why does God see us as beautiful, as fair, like he did with Moses, like he does with all of his creation, and like we should do with our children? Why? What is man that you're mindful of him? Genesis 1 and verse 26 says that man was created in the image of God. Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. And then he crowned him with glory and honor, made him have dominion over the rest of creation. That's who man is. He's not like the animals. We aren't animals. Our body will return to the dust of the earth, but the spirit will return to God who gave it and who is the image of our spirit. Made in the image of God. He created us for a purpose. To more than any other facet of His creation, glorify Him. Psalm 19 in verse 1 tells us, the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows His handiwork. If the heavens and nature glorify God as we look to them as the evidence of an almighty Creator and Designer, infinite God, how much more the pinnacle of creation, those who are made in His image. Psalm 100 says, make a joyful shout to the Lord, all you lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before His presence with singing. Know that the Lord, He is God. It is He who made us, and not we ourselves. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture. So enter into His gates with thanksgiving and into His courts with praise. Be thankful to Him and bless His name. For the Lord is good, His mercy is everlasting, and His truth endures to all generations. That's who the child is. That's how the parents need to view their children. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, viewing their little brothers and sisters. That's how they view them. This one is given by God, created in God's image, and he or she is made for the glory of God, to serve God. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13 tells us that. What is the conclusion? Here's the conclusion of the whole matter, Solomon says, in all his wisdom and in inspiration of the Spirit. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil, even of that little child. One day, that child's going to grow to be an accountable age, to have the responsibility to either obey God or reject God. And you had better believe, like Romans 3 and verse 23, that all of sin, that child, when he reaches or she reaches the accountable age, will make the terrible decision to forsake God. But if you teach that child that that was a failure, that you're to fear God and keep His commandments, then you can also teach that child of the grace and mercy of God. fact that if you render yourself subservient to Him, you'll have the hope of heaven again. You'll be restored to your Almighty Creator. This is a lesson about parents. You view your child in that way. It's a gift from God, and it's not a gift from God to the world. It's not a gift from God to you only. It's a gift from God put in your care to raise that child in such a way that they acknowledge that God exists and that my purpose, they think and they know, is to fear Him and keep His commandments. So many parents in this life look at their children and they think that this is another chance for me. I failed. I could have been a better athlete. I could have been a better businessman. I could have been a better hunter. I could have been better in these regards. So I'm going to raise my child so that I can live through my child. I can be successful through my child. That's not what your child is for. Your child is not to be a good athlete. You're not to train them to be a good football player or basketball player or tennis player, any other thing of that nature. You're not raising that child to be a master huntsman. You're not raising that child to be good in business and rake in all the cash that they can, to be successful, to be at the top of the world. You're not raising that child to cure cancer. That child is there to fear God and keep His commandments. And God has entrusted you to raise that child to understand that. That's a grave responsibility. Falls in the hands of the parents. And they're given that appointment, as Proverbs 22 and verse 6 says, to train up the child in the way he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it. There is a way that that child is intended to go, a standard that tells us that way. It's not in ourselves, Jeremiah 10:23. Because what our way may be is the end of death, Proverbs 14 and verse 12. There's a way that that child should go, and God has entrusted you to train him or her up into that way. And He has given you the assurance that if you do right by him or her and God, that the general rule is that child will understand their purpose and they will not depart from that way. You know, the end of that way is eternal life with God. That's the responsibility parents have. That's why when Amram and Jochebed received Moses back into their care after they let him go by faith, they took advantage of the few days, few years, however long it was that they had to teach him something about the God of the universe so he didn't fall into idolatry and into the pleasures of sin and into the riches that were there offered to him, but he chose rather to suffer for God. To suffer for God's purposes and to lay up the eternal treasures of heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4 places the fathers at the helm of this grave appointment. Ephesians 6 and verse 4 says, you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath as you're disciplining them. Don't provoke them to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. That's your purpose. And if you're not doing it, if you decide to squander that responsibility, you're not a good parent. You're not a good father. That's what the fathers do. Fathers don't teach their children to be good athletes. Fathers don't teach their children the way of manhood or mothers teaching their children the way of womanhood in this life, but the way of faith, the way of the Lord. Bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. And fathers so many times abdicate that responsibility, and God says, you're not a good father. I don't care what your wife says, what the world says, what society says. If you don't train your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, you're missing the whole point. Bring your children up. Mothers, you're not exempt from this either. We're familiar with the Proverbs 31 woman. Look at what the Scripture says of that woman in verse 26. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. And it says that she watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. And a lot of times we talk about how this woman is industrious, And she's watching over her household in the way that she provides for them, gives them clothing so they're not cold. And all of that plays into this. But I want us to notice verse 30. He says, charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. If she fears the Lord, that's at the forefront of every decision she makes. And a mother who is doing what God wants her to do as that child's caretaker and under the leadership of the husband is to have the law of kindness and wisdom on her tongue, to give attention to every opportunity. The father's the breadwinner, to train that little soul up to know God, to fear God, to be a servant of God. Deuteronomy chapter 6, Moses, in reciting the law, gives great responsibility to the parents. It would be key to the success of the spiritual people of Israel as they went into the Canaan land. It starts in the home. When Moses says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." Notice this. "These words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, always before you. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." Look at verse 20. "When your son asks you, in time to come, saying, 'What is the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you?' It says, 'Tell them about the deliverance from Egypt.'" But notice down in verse 24, this is what you tell them. What's the purpose of the Bible? What's the purpose of our... Why am I here, Mom? Why am I here, Dad? Beautiful to God for His service. "The Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that He might preserve us alive as it is this day. Then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all these commandments before the Lord our God as He has commanded us." There is no greater responsibility than having that given by God to raise this child and the way he should go, where she should go, that they would learn about God, that they would have God in their minds every day, that they would grow in the Word of the Lord to serve Him, to fear Him and keep His commandments. Because you know what? When the football season is over, when the basketball season is over, when hunting season is over, when that child grows up into an adult and that child lives their lives and they die of old age or the Lord is sent again, all of that doesn't matter anymore. They will give an answer for everything they've done, whether good or bad, and they will have an eternal existence in a place of excruciating pain and sorrow and anguish, or a place of eternal bliss in the comfort of the One who created them. Not only that, but the parent will be judged by how they raised that child. Let us never forget the importance of the home, of teaching our children, of making sure they know about God and recognizing that they came from God and that they're for God. They're not to just serve you and bring you a Coke from the fridge when you don't want to get off of the recliner. They're not just to mow the grass when they reach that age. They're not for any other purpose than to fear God and keep His commandments, to glorify God as is your purpose. And the parent has the responsibility of instilling that in them by teaching them the Scriptures. If you miss that, you miss everything. We need to remember that always. If you're here this morning and you have not obeyed the gospel, what we want to do in the last part of this lesson is to offer an invitation, because you too, like all people, were created in the image of God. And what Paul tells us by inspiration of the Spirit is that there reaches a time when you are responsible for your actions and all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. The only way to have those sins forgiven is the blood of the Lamb, the blood of the Son of God that was shed for you. And the only way to come into contact with that blood is to believe in Him, believe the Scriptures, and to be baptized for the remission of your sins. You have that opportunity this morning. And if you've done that and you've forgotten about your purpose, and you've gone away from the way that you were raised in, the way you should go, God has granted us this time as opportunity to get back into His good favor. Don't squander this opportunity. If there's any spiritual need we can assist you with, come forward while we stand and sing the song of invitation.